This is Audible.
Hello, and welcome to the Bob Edwards Show for Friday, June 20th. Los Angeles Times Washington columnist Doyle McManus begins our program today with analysis of the week's political news. Then we'll hear from Tony DiCoppo, whose father smuggled tons of weed into the country before his eventual self-destruction. DiCoppo's memoir is titled The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. And later in the hour, award-winning science journalist Rebecca Coffey, who contributes to Scientific American and Discover magazines. She tells us about her novel that unravels the history of psychoanalysis, same-sex desire, and the Freud family. Her book is titled Hysterical, Anna Freud's Story. Islamic fundamentalism gained momentum throughout the Arab world during the 1980s. 30 years ago, we were introduced to the groups Islamic Jihad in Lebanon and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Later, we learned about the brutal rule of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and with the USS Cole and 9/11, Al-Qaeda. And now the list keeps growing across more of the globe. Boko Haram in Nigeria, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and of course ISIS in Iraq. Doyle McManus is here with a primer on who's where and why they fight. He's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times and joins me now. Hi, Doyle.
Hello, Bob.
First of all, what was happening in and around the 80s to spawn this tide of Islamic fundamentalism?
Well, first of all, we should make a distinction between Islamic religious fundamentalism and the kind of political fundamentalist movements we're all worried about now. The religious fundamentalism has been around for centuries. But yeah, in the 1980s, a couple of things happened. One was the failure of the old secular regimes in the Arab world and Iran. People were looking for a different political path, and that sent a lot of ordinary Muslims back to Islam. But then a couple of other things happened. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and that led to the backlash in Afghanistan by Islamists, the Mujahideen, the Taliban, who fought the Soviets and won, which gave them sort of their founding myth that we can beat these superpowers. And then a series of American interventions in other parts of the Muslim world, including Lebanon in 1983, and then the first Gulf War in 1990, and that all snowballed into what we see today.
And at the same time, everyday Americans heard mostly about strongmen like Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. Was it assumed that Islamic fundamentalist groups were just local entities, dangerous only to U.S. personnel and materiel there in the region?
To some degree, because initially they were only engaged locally, although that still made them a threat to Americans. If you think of, for example, the bombing of the American embassy in Beirut in 1983, well, that was a local group, but it was obviously an attack on the United States. But then, of course, what happened after the Gulf War was the rise of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's focus on hitting the United States directly, and that really did change the picture and got our attention.
So let's look first at the group that's been doing so much damage in Iraq, ISIS. Who are they, and what's their goal?
Well, ISIS, which stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, to be technical, or in Iraq and Syria, really, started out as a bunch of Islamist groups in Iraq who were fighting the United States during the occupation that followed our invasion of 2003. They were pretty much defeated in Iraq by 2010. They moved across the line into Syria and began recruiting people there and fought, of course, in the Syrian Revolution. And now they are back in Iraq, and they basically have two goals. One is that they want to establish an Islamic State in whatever area they can capture, whether it's in Syria or Iraq or both. But the other, and really the more troubling one in a big regional sense, is they explicitly want to set off a sectarian war between Islam's two biggest factions, its two biggest sects, the Sunni and the Shia. They want a war that would blow up the entire region because they think that would serve their interests.
The organizer of the Benghazi attacks is now in custody, Ahmed Abu Qatala. He is said to have ties to Al-Qaeda. Should we assume all Islamic fundamentalists across the Arab world are tied in some way to Al-Qaeda?
Not really, because many of them simply are not. In other cases, as in Libya, the connections are very, very loose. In some cases, local groups have taken the brand name of Al-Qaeda because it's a good recruiting tool, whether they have any actual connection or not. In other cases, they have sent letters to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda, back in the mountains of Pakistan, saying, okay, we're working here. What, you know, do we have your blessing? And of course, this points up what has changed in Al-Qaeda over time, and that is that it has changed from a small central organization under Osama bin Laden that was solely focused on hitting America to this kind of odd franchise operation that's doing uprisings just about anywhere it can.
Al-Qaeda's beef with ISIS in Iraq, is that just about tactics, or is it a more basic disagreement?
No, it's pretty basic, and there's an interesting example, because this is a group that was an official Al-Qaeda franchise, but in February of this year, Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda, basically expelled them, said, you guys are too extreme. Now, you know you're in trouble when a group is so extreme that Al-Qaeda says, you're too far out for us. But the problem is both tactics and strategy. In terms of tactics, ISIS is unbelievably brutal in what it does when it moves into a place. And in terms of strategy, their basic strategy of touching off this sectarian war among Muslims actually offends a lot of people in Al-Qaeda. Zawahiri, in one of his communications, said, this makes no sense to promote war among Muslims as a way to fix the Muslim world.
So is ISIS a threat to us domestically, like Al-Qaeda proved to be?
Not yet. Its focus is still local in Syria and Iraq. Now, that's a threat to American interests. It's, of course, it's a big part of the world. It touches a lot of other countries that are also important to us. It's a big oil-producing area. Already the price of oil has gone up, so it's not something we can be indifferent to. But the other issue here, of course, is that American officials are worried that if they get implanted in a piece of territory, a lot of terrorists are already flocking to their banner. Some of those people will want to plan attacks against the United States and against Europe. And several hundred of those people, at least, already out there in the desert, are people with American or European passports who would be very difficult to detect if they came back home.
Al-Qaeda trained in Afghanistan under the protection of the Taliban. Osama bin Laden was captured next door in Pakistan, and we heard a lot about Al-Qaeda operating in the lawless region between those two countries. Is that still Al-Qaeda's home base?
Yes, it still is, which is one of the reasons that Afghanistan is still important to Americans. But it's less important to Al-Qaeda than it used to be, because they're now operating in so many different places. Not only Iraq, not only Syria, but also Yemen and parts of Africa like Mali and Nigeria and Somalia. But again, not all of these offshoots are equally dangerous to the United States.
What about the offshoots in Africa? Tell me about Al-Shabaab.
Well, Shabaab is an interesting case because, again, it originally was just a local issue. It was a local militia. Shabaab really means just the young men or the guys who came out of an Islamic regime and who have been fighting the very shaky government in Somalia for a decade now. But its leader has also said that attacks against American installations are important, and they are believed to be guilty for the attack against the United States Embassy in Kenya in 1998. So these two categories sort of flow together, the local revolution and the attack on Americans.
Most of us became familiar with Boko Haram when they kidnapped those schoolgirls in Nigeria. Boko Haram translates to Western education is sinful. And that seems a pretty fundamental position to take.
Yeah, that also may be a bad translation. That's not their official name. Their official name is the Group for Propagation of the Prophet's Teachings and for Jihad. But that's kind of a mouthful. Boko in the Hausa language of Nigeria actually means fraud or deception. What it really means is non-Muslim education is sinful. But still, It's a very radical group. It's led by a very erratic leader. Again, not yet a threat specifically to Americans or Western interests, but anybody who's kidnapping hundreds of schoolgirls shouldn't be ignored.
If fundamentalists take over a country and run it, whether it's Nigeria or Afghanistan or Iraq, should we oppose them on principle or just let them be as long as they don't attack us?
Well, there are plenty of governments in the Muslim world that actually are religiously fundamentalist or religiously rigorous, and one that comes to mind is Saudi Arabia, which is actually an American ally. So the religious character of the regime isn't automatically a recipe for terrorism. And if you think about Afghanistan in the 1990s, there was not a whole lot of attacks against the United States coming out of the Taliban initially. So the real problem here is which of these movements, which of these governments, which of these regions are going to threaten American interests, and which of them are going to shelter terrorists who attack us directly.
Thank you, Doyle.
Thank you.
Doyle McManus is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. A story born of our increasing liberalization on the subject of pot. That's after a break. Welcome back. By the time Tony DiCoppo was in high school, his father had sold more than half the marijuana in the United States. DiCoppo says his father and mother built a fortune in South Florida from weed, a drug they both tried and enjoyed in college. He talks more about his family, his father in particular, and his latest book, The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana.
The Great Stoned Age is a name that many people use to describe the greatest explosion of illicit drug use ever recorded, a period roughly from the late 60s until 1979, marijuana use peaked. Cocaine use continued on from there before falling off pretty dramatically during the Reagan years.
Marijuana was not banned until 1970?
Well, there was a technicality. The reefer madness era of the 1930s yielded a complicated middle position, a marijuana tax. So if you were caught with marijuana, you had to pay a $100 fine, and most people couldn't pay that tax, and so they were busted for fraud, tax fraud. It wasn't because you had the marijuana, it was because you weren't paying your taxes.
Give us some details of Nixon's 1972 National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse.
Nixon came into office, and there was a huge movement to legalize, and he was very much against it because most of the people who wanted to legalize seemed to also be very much against Richard Nixon. But he wanted to appear to be fair. So he appointed a big presidential blue ribbon commission, and it was led by the governor of Pennsylvania. Had a lot of Republicans on it. He felt as though he had stacked it pretty well, and the outcome was going to come in his favor, a recommendation against legalization. And lo and behold, it is unveiled, and the conclusion of this commission on marijuana is that marijuana is not a problem. It poses no medical or health risk, and it should be decriminalized.
So?
So Nixon, this was not front page news, believe it or not. Nixon succeeded in getting the press to bury it on page whatever, Infinity. And he went forward saying that marijuana would only lead more of our young people down a road to ruin and recklessness and probably voting against Richard Nixon. So war on drugs.
Did they repeal the tax?
They replaced the tax with an outright ban. The very famous Controlled Substances Act was passed in 1970, and it tabbed marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance, same as heroin. No medical value, high potential for abuse, the worst of the worst, and that's where it lives today.
Tell us about weed and President Carter's administration.
Well, the Carter administration was more evolved than any administration ever on marijuana. They came in on a platform of decriminalization, and the equivalent of the drug czar, Peter Bourne, the guy who ran drug policy for Carter, he told Congress that we should decriminalize this. The Judicial Committee within the Senate actually approved a bill to decriminalize, and then Carter gave a big speech in August of 77 on the floor of Congress saying no drug should have a penalty that's more harmful than the drug itself, and for this reason, I think we should decriminalize marijuana. That was front page news. And people in the marijuana business felt like, oh my God, like my father felt like, we just have to get more of this. We're on the ground floor of something huge. Little did they know that everything was going to come crashing down and Reagan was going to be in charge in 18 months.
Well, Carter was a farmer, you know.
I mean, I think His policy is, in fact, the one I would imagine the Obama administration will eventually come around to supporting. They may not fully legalize the way we have in Colorado and Washington State, you know, creating a commercial market, but Carter was in favor of decriminalizing, which means everyone who gets caught smoking, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who are busted just for possession, that goes away to zero overnight. And you still, it's still a deterrent. You still say, look, we don't think society should be doing this on a wide-scale basis, and if you're dealing, we'll put you in jail. But, you know, smokers are set free.
How did your father fit into the story?
My father, like a lot of people in the late 1960s who were college-aged, was smoking marijuana. A lot of his friends were smoking marijuana. And he realized that it was pretty heroic if you could not only smoke it, but get it and give it to your friends. So when he was casting around after dropping out of graduate school, looking for work, looking for money, he found a connection, and he started to sell. And the year he started to sell was around the same time that Interpol put out a report on the nature of marijuana dealing internationally and mostly in America. And it said the dealer today is different from prior criminals. He's from, quote, higher social levels. And he has a college degree, and he's age 24. And when that report came out, my father was almost exactly a fit. I mean, you could have put his face on the cover.
Where did your father get the capital to become a dealer?
He needed $2,000. So his first big buy-in was one where the guy who gave it to him wasn't fully convinced that my father was going to be able to sell it. And typically in the business, you got the product on loan, a very small upfront payment, and you paid the rest when you sold it, as you sold it. It's called on the arm. My father was not a proven dealer, so the guy said, look, you're going to have to give me 50% or more. I think it was $2,000. My father was like, geez, this is 1971, 72. That money is a lot. That's a lot of money. So he went to my mother, and she went to the teachers union to try to get a loan from them. No dice. So then they went to her father, who ran a grocery store in New York State. And they said, look, you know, we want to get our own place and be responsible and start a life of our own. Can we have this money? We'll pay you back, we promise. And he said, sure. So they didn't exactly lie. They didn't exactly tell the truth. But they got their money. And my father sold the weed, lickety-split, as he likes to say. And he was off to the races from there.
You describe him as a drifter, laborer, sometimes painter, and one-time security guard who by his 30th birthday was making more money than 98% of American men.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, New York Magazine in 1975 said marijuana smoking is one of the only industries in America, or marijuana selling is one of the only businesses in America where you can start out with a dollar today and be a millionaire within 2 years. And my father was on that trajectory.
Is this a great country or what? So what's it like growing up with a father who worked as a drug dealer?
It's confusing because I essentially was a human cover story. I didn't know what he was doing, and if anyone was suspicious, it might look like he's just a family man, which he effectively was. We palled around in Miami, going to tourist haunts and hanging out at the beach and tooling around town in his Mercedes. And he just happened to disappear for summers to plan jobs and then for much of the fall to make sales. And it wasn't until years and years later that I realized what he was really up to.
How old were you?
When I found out for sure, I was in my late 20s, pushing 30. And I found out because I called the National Archive. And my parents call me the white sheep. I am not, in a family of black sheep, I am the white sheep. I have somewhat of a conservative streak. I'd always been kind of the good kid, with some slip-ups, but basically the good kid. And so they weren't frank with me about where the money had come from growing up. And I was left to find out on my own. So I called the National Archives, keeper of 1% of America's documents, the most important documents, the ones we want forever. And I said, do you have a record for this individual? Thinking they would not. But sure enough, they send me his indictment from 1986, and it's for 35,000 pounds of marijuana, 17 tons, on 6 sailboats, one job. And he'd been doing that for 15 years at that point.
You never found his stash, never wondered about the excess of baggies in the house?
No, because in the 1980s, everyone's parents were doing drugs. I mean, drugs were everywhere, right? The great lie in the 80s was, you know, the parents were saying just say no, and they were putting the little ribbons on their cars and driving you to school. But meanwhile, you know, that every night, they're putting lines of cocaine on the table themselves. So I knew that he had a drug problem, and that was explicitly, that was made clear to me, and there were even handy books written in that decade to help children understand. One was called The Brown Bottle, and it was about a caterpillar who crawls inside a bottle that used to have booze in it and likes the sensation, never comes out, never becomes a butterfly. So that was my education on on drug abuse. I knew he had a drug abuse problem.
Where did he get his supply?
He got it from Colombia. So in the 70s, most of the marijuana came from Mexico, and he started selling Mexican. But Mexico had problems. Mexico was on the metric system, which confused a lot of the gringos coming down. And also, in the late 70s, Mexico started getting sprayed pretty heavily. There was a chemical called paraquat that the American government was dumping on marijuana crops. And there were terrible rumors about how if you smoked this, you'd go blind, it would eat away your lungs. It turned out to be totally untrue. But the whole market, which was convened by High Times magazine, the whole market was like, forget Mexican, we want to go Colombian or maybe Jamaican. And so the great myth machine started whirring, and Colombian weed became the great dangerous get, the thing you wanted. And my father pulled the chain of associations that got him a connection, and again, he was off to the races.
How much would he get? How often?
It would be one or two jobs a year because the jobs would be multi-ton jobs. So I think the first job was 8 tons, and they went up from there, and they finished with that 17-ton job in 86. And just to give you a sense of the scale, I mean, there's a gram of marijuana. This is cleaned tonnage. So the guy who went to the mountains was a man named Willie Terry, and he would clean the marijuana there. He wouldn't be smuggling the dusty, stem-filled, seed-filled stuff. He would actually spend days in the mountains and pull it all apart and pack it in a very tight way. He would complain. There's a government transcript with him complaining about blisters on his fingers. So what was arriving was very, very tight marijuana, and 1 gram rolls a joint. And if you have 17 tons, you can roll millions and millions of joints. I did the calculations once, and it was enough to roll a joint for every college-age person in America.
So forget about ounces and pounds. Your father moved tons.
Tons, yeah. You know, it came, it was a four-man ring. It was my father and his partner who were like the guys in the tall grass, and it was my future stepfather, just to get a hint at the melodrama here. I mean, my future stepfather and Willie Terry were the guys bringing it on the boats from Colombia. They'd meet at the water line, pass the product off, and it would go into the lungs of America.
Yeah, a friend of your father's helped grow his business, right?
Yes. My father met a very connected a Brooklyn kid who was a behind-the-scenes operator with a lot of connections. My father would not have been anywhere near as successful as he was if not for this guy. You know, if you needed a forklift by 3 p.m., this was the man to call, and he'd get you the registration and everything. Brooklyn was quite the epicenter for marijuana dealing in the 80s. There was multiple people told me stories about this guy who used to sell scales in Brooklyn. I have no idea if this is totally true or not, but I love the story. Apparently, there was one guy who sold scales in Brooklyn, egg-shaped shopkeeper, and you know the same guys would come in, and then you know one year they'd buy the small scale because they're small scale dealers, and then they'd get the medium scale, and then they'd get the medium scale in a cart, and then eventually some of them would end up getting like the ton level scale, the thing you use for bales of bales of hay, you know, in the middle of Brooklyn. It's like everyone knows what they're doing.
Your mother was involved in the business too, right?
My mother was, like a lot of people in the era, she was an enthusiast for marijuana. She felt like it was access to peace and love, and it wasn't hurting anybody, and that the government was wrong to be banning it. So it was a righteous flouting of the law, and so she was a supporter. She was not a supporter of the excess that surrounded the marijuana, the cocaine use of the deal. So the marijuana dealers sometimes let themselves slide into cocaine use, even though they would never sell it themselves. And so she drew the line there. She wasn't into that part of the excess, but in terms of the simple selling of weed, she was all for it.
Stashing money?
Well, you know, having a lot of money that's criminal becomes a problem at a certain point. You can only launder so much, and unless you're really committed, laundering is almost like a full-time job. You know, my father had a front company in the late 70s in Vermont that built homes. They would he had a whole building crew, master carpenters, and they would sell these homes for about $200,000 a piece, and it would be sold on a loss, but it'd be a profit because all the money behind it was generated through an illicit business, and the sale would make it clean. But, you know, that takes work. And at a certain point, my father was like, I don't want to be doing this work. So that's when he started burying the money.
Did your father see himself as an outlaw, a pirate?
He was obsessed with the idea of outlaws, and he was typical in that obsession. He read all the crime novels. It was routine for the cops to bust up marijuana rings and find and cocaine rings too, and find, you know, movie posters on the walls and crime documentaries in VHS cassettes. I mean, they were self-conscious outlaws. They felt like they were gentlemen who abided by the greater laws of being nice to women and good to society and against the evil government.
Mm-hmm. How many times was he arrested?
For marijuana dealing, only once. I mean, he had a DUI in the late 70s for just being a I don't know how frank I can be. I mean, he was just being an idiot. He was on the way to becoming a father, and he did a job there and hung around a party and just got arrested peeling out in a gravelly parking lot outside a bar with an open bottle. He's just an idiot. And then he got busted for cocaine possession during his really bad downfall period in the late 80s. And then in the early 90s, he was pinched for that job in 86. It was a retrospective case.
You said, my father walked into a 30-day rehab in January 1985, feeling like a man one step ahead of a falling piano.
My father's mantra was always, I'm only going to be in the business until I'm going to make $1 million. And then when I make $1 million, I'm going to get out. And he was telling people that in the 80s. What he wasn't telling them is that he'd already made $1 million once, and he'd made $1 million twice. And, you know, by 85, he was working on his third million, and he just kept pissing it away on his own addictions, his own appetites. My father's reaction to the book, he called me, and I was anxious to get the call, and I knew he'd read it, and he started by correcting all these, spelling errors, and bail was spelled B-A-I-L instead of B-A-L-E, like all this piddling stuff. And I was like, okay, he's coming around to something big here. What's he going to say? And then finally he's like, you know, I don't think you got my appetites. I was like, what do you mean your appetites? And he's like, there's not enough hookers. There's not enough hookers.
How long did your father live with you and your mother?
He walked away in 86 and was still semi-present in my life, but did not live with us. He had an apartment on Brickell Avenue, less than a mile from the famous Atlantis condominiums from Miami Vice, the Miami Vice opening credits. I wish I did. My kid's 5 now, roughly around the same age when he moved out. I would love to move to a Gemara on the Biscayne Bay.
You write that you made him up. You said, I had no father, so I made up a father.
I did. You know, when you have an absence instead of a presence, you need, for one's personal narrative, for one's self-story, to draw a line from the past to the present. Where did I come from? Who am I? What kind of confidence can I have in my genes, in my lineage? And so I took the little bit I knew about him, that he had been involved in drugs, and I created a myth in my own head.
How much time passed before you saw your father again?
Oh, man. It was 2006 when I decided to jump him. So 15 years, a little more than 15 years. We had traded some letters, and I had wanted to see him, and then what I learned about him made me think, I can't face this guy. He's not going to live up to the myth in my head. Eventually I was driving by where I knew he lived in Cambridge, or this was actually in a different part of Boston at the time. And I said, you know what, the hell with it. I'm going to drop in on him. So I took the exit, found the address, waited till another resident came out, slipped in the door, and I hung out in the lobby until my old man walked out of the elevator and I recognized him.
All fathers pass on lessons to their children. What did you get from your father?
Well, I got one lesson in particular, and that is that there are always a set of words that you can use to open any door. And it's not magic, but it's about reading people, anticipating what their needs are, and then when the pins fall into place and the lock clicks, pushing that door open. And that was my father's essential skill. Who you work with in the drug business is one of the biggest decisions a person makes. And my father was consistently able to convince people who knew him not at all to work with him. And if there's a skill that I'd like to harvest from him that I would hope that he passed on, it's that. It's reading people and getting through.
Well, you make it sound like a sales seminar.
It, you know, at a certain point in his career, he probably could have run a night school class on how to pay people, how to keep them happy, how to motivate. You know, he was always a present force in the business. Sometimes when major drug dealers would get busted, their lawyers would make a scene in front of the jury and say, look, this is ridiculous. This individual, he is a major drug dealer, allegedly, and yet he was caught driving the car or he was caught down at the block. He's a lackey. You've got the wrong guy. And that was always utter shuck because the guy who was the big timer didn't want to, he didn't get into it to keep his hands clean, right? The fun was being in the stash house. The fun was handling the bales at the shoreline. That was the thrill. That was the greatest feeling in the world.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, bye.
NBC News writer Tony DiCoppo discussing his book, The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. After the break, science journalist Rebecca Coffey. It's the Bob Edwards Show on SiriusXM Public Radio. Rebecca Coffey was interested in the unexamined, less popular parts of Sigmund Freud's life. Her interest led her to research the life of his daughter, Anna. Anna Freud was a lesbian who lived in a monogamous relationship for most of her life in her father's house. This fascinated Coffey for a number of reasons, mostly because Freud didn't believe in same-sex love for women. Coffey fused her research with her imagination, coming up with a novel steeped in true accounts of Anna and Sigmund Freud's life. It's called Hysterical, Anna Freud's Story.
Anna Freud was Sigmund Freud's smartest daughter. She was the last of six children. She was born in 1885, and she was the least favored child. She was the mistake. Her mother went on a long tour of Europe shortly after she was born. Her father declared their sexual life over, and her mother's sister moved in to take over her place. And indeed, she became Sigmund's mistress. Nobody much cared about this daughter. She was the least pretty of the three daughters, and the three boys were all brilliant. So she grew up envying the boys because she wasn't pretty. There was no way she was going to envy the girls. And she wanted an education like theirs, but her father wouldn't let her have one. That's not what girls did.
Didn't she have a rivalry with her sister, Sophie?
She did. She had a terrible rivalry with Sophie because Sophie was the favorite daughter. Mm. Sophie was also the closest one in age to her. Sophie was beautiful. And Anna was born the same year that psychoanalysis was born. So she had to struggle with psychoanalysis for her father's attention and with Sophie. So Anna wasn't a very pleasant child growing up. She was difficult. Everyone found her difficult. When she was a teenager, she got sent away from the family for 4 months and forbidden to come to Sophie's wedding because she would only make trouble.
So why have you chosen to tell Anna's story in this way, in a novel through Anna's voice?
Okay, so I had been researching another book years ago, and I was doing some research about Freud and found out a bit about some intellectual deception that he had done. And so I started researching more. It was kind of side research. And I noticed as I researched his bibliographies that they gave information about everyone in detail, even the garbage man you got to know. But a name came up every once in a while, Dorothy Tiffany Burlingham, and then there was no more information about her. She was always described as Anna's friend, Dorothy Tiffany Burlingham. Nothing else. And so I became curious. And I also noticed that part of the family stories were all of these men that almost hooked up with Anna, that she almost married, but somehow decided not to. And it sounded to me suspiciously like the kinds of stories that mothers and aunts tell when they don't know quite what's going on with a girl. And the more I read, the more convinced I became that Anna might be gay. And then I came across a book written by Jeffrey Musayef-Maison, who had been the projects director for a while at the Freud Archives, the Freud Museum. He had lived he had worked in the house that Anna and Dorothy were living in after everyone else had died. And his job was to rummage through the cubbyholes and the desks and try to piece together a historical picture of what had happened. And he was intrigued by the relationship between these two women. They had been together since the 20s, and this was the 80s, or maybe the very late 70s, and they had always been served by the same maid. And so Jeffrey started to ask people, friends and family, are they a couple? And everyone took offense at the question and wouldn't answer. So he did the obvious thing, and he asked the maid. The way he phrased the question was, do Miss Freud and Miss Burlingham share a bedroom? And I don't remember her precise response, but what she said was essentially, oh, no, sir. They each have their own bedroom, and they use one or another, whichever they please. So then I looked at that and thought, I have a book.
Now, why the title, Hysterical?
All right, because one of Sigmund Freud's early central tenets was that men acquire their morality through the castration complex. They're afraid of losing that member which is most important to them. Women have nothing to lose. So they only gain morality by relating long-term to one stable man. They take their guidance from their husband once they're adults. If you don't have a husband, you're in deep trouble as a woman. You are lesbianism. Making love with a woman instead of a man not only takes you out of the chain of reproduction, which is important, but also leaves you afloat on the terrible sea of life without guidance. So it is a gateway to mental collapse. And part of the symptomatology of mental collapse is hysteria. So here I was looking at potentially the story of a young gay girl growing up in a family in which her world-famous father was spouting that theory, in which she was struggling with her sisters and with psychoanalysis itself for his attention. How did she end up in a 54-year monogamous relationship with another woman and loving and caring for her father? How did she pull that off? And part of the reason I think she could do it is that they came from a family of great humor. And so that's the other reason for Hysterical in the title. I think Anna made sense of the confusing world around her by reframing things with humor.
So tell me about your research.
Well, I read everything written by either Anna or Sigmund and everything written about them. I read all of the biographies and all of their writings. The biographies, as I said, all skipped right over who Dorothy Burlingham was. The papers of Sigmund and Anna were very revealing. Beginning at around age 6, she had had masturbation fantasies. She called them beating fantasies, in which she was beaten by an enraged father figure. Both Anna and Sigmund described those in their papers. He gave a paper in 1920 at a conference, an international conference. At those conferences, she would typically sit in the wife's chair. So she was in full view while he read about a little girl's beating fantasies and daydreams. How embarrassing must that have been for her? And then, several years later, when she wanted to join the Psychoanalytic Society, she had to present a paper, but she'd never treated anyone before, analyzed anyone before. So she presented herself as a case. When he presented it, it was called A Child is Being Beaten. When she presented it, she called it Beating Fantasies and Daydreams. It was very apparent to everyone that they were the same child. And that gave away a huge secret, which was he had psychoanalyzed his own daughter, which went against his cardinal rule. He thought and he taught that psychoanalysis is essentially an erotic arena and you should never try this at home. And I believe that he tried it at home because he was concerned about her homosexuality. He believed that homosexuality on the part of a woman is always the fault of the father, and it is always curable by psychoanalysis. So he had to do something about it, or they were two black marks, public black marks, on his character.
Right, so how did he deal with that?
Psychoanalyzed her. They did, by my estimation, about 1,000 hours of psychoanalysis. Now, I couldn't do that in a book, so I simplified and I abbreviated. But I do show her feelings at having to reveal herself sexually to her father. I believe it probably set up lots of confusion between them. Another part of his teachings, at the birth of civilization, incest was declared forbidden. So she knew that whatever longings were going to be generated in psychoanalysis were not going to be fulfilled. So as an author, I never have him touch her, but I do play with the erotic confusion that must have been set up by talking with your daughter about her sexual fantasies.
She was the only one of his children who followed him into the field.
Yes, and she was the only one whom he chose to psychoanalyze. So what kind of a position did that place her in within her family?
And she specialized in children.
She specialized in children, in traumatized children, which to me is an obvious extension of the trauma she went through as a child. Now, she didn't specialize in sexually traumatized or sexually confused children. Her children came from difficult families, but mostly they were traumatized by war. And she really grew into a remarkable human being. She and Dorothy raised Dorothy's 4 children, but they also set up war orphanages so that they were taking the children of the nurses and soldiers in London, and they were raising them, and they figured out that really children need more than schedules and lesson plans and rules. They need people to whom to attach. So they would assign children to faux families so that for the years that you would stay with Dorothy and Anna, you were loved by somebody. You didn't emerge from that feeling unloved and an orphan. You emerged from that as a whole human being. She took in children whose parents were working in the war effort. She took in war orphans. And then after the war was ended, she took in children from one of the concentration camps. Mm. So she really worked heroically. Mm. And she also was one of the founders of education in which children were taught to learn with their hearts and their hands. Dorothy and Anna had been raising their children in the Austrian education system, which is a fairly brutal, rule-bound education system. And because Dorothy's children didn't even speak German to start out with, it was terribly difficult. They began to homeschool, and they brought in children of other psychoanalytic patients, because if you're being raised in a house that's inward-looking, you don't fit in well to the Austrian schools in the 1930s. And so they started a large private school, and they tried to get the children to understand how to see inside themselves and how to work with their hands and their hearts.
And Anna cared for her father throughout his life, right?
She did. She edged aside her mother and her mother's sister. Her mother's sister was Sigmund's long-term mistress, living in the family. So the three of them were really a couple. She has edged aside both ladies and became his primary caretaker. As he became frail, she shared a bed with him. So one way to look at how she juggled all the balls in her life was that she became the spouse of 2 people, her father and of Dorothy. She loved them both very well.
What would he do as she was telling him about her dreams?
Well, Sigmund always sat in a chair behind the head of the reclining patient, so the patient couldn't see him. And I imagine he just sat there and smoked and asked questions.
Can you tell us about some of Anna's fantasies?
They evolved over time. At the beginning, they were just of a nameless, faceless boy and a nameless, faceless father figure. and nothing happened other than the beating. And it was sexual. She always masturbated. As she matured, the characters acquired nuance, and so did the plot. There was a terrible misdeed that the boy had done, and the boy became Anna Freud.
Most fathers do not want to hear about their daughters' goings on.
No, they don't. They don't ask. They know not to ask. So, and he knew not to ask. Now, all of his biographers ignored this. And when one historian discovered it and wrote about it, everyone said, this doesn't matter at all. They knew how to handle that. And it was a non-aligned historian who commented and said, oh my gosh, this man was Peter Gay and he was writing a biography. Oh my gosh, he flouted his cardinal rule.
Was this well known in Sigmund Freud's lifetime?
It was not. They kept it a secret until it was revealed. I think it was revealed in the late 70s or early 80s, and everybody ignored it. It was, these people are very good at, I guess, what Anna Freud, as an adult, she taught about the defense mechanisms, and one of the defense mechanisms is denial. And let me tell you, the psychoanalytic community had that down pat.
I'm speaking with science journalist Rebecca Coffey about her latest book, Hysterical, Anna Freud's Story. Our conversation will continue after a break. Welcome back. Psychoanalysis was all the rage at the turn of the 20th century, and Sigmund Freud was the man who knew it all. Science journalist Rebecca Coffey explores the details of Freud's life, his family, and takes special interest in one of his daughters, Anna. Anna wasn't as popular as her older sisters, yet she became her father's most prized student. Coffey talks more about their relationship in her book, Hysterical, Anna Freud's Story.
They lived, Dorothy and Anna lived upstairs from the Freud family. So she never really separated from the family. They integrated her into it. And Sigmund referred to them both as virgins. And to that, Marie Bonaparte added that Anna was a Vestal virgin.
Didn't Anna defend her father's views on
absolutely
women and sexuality?
Absolutely. And that's part of what I was so fascinated by. How do you defend those views even though they are harming you? The way I describe it in the author's note is that the damage he did to her was the same damage that a gardener does to create a bonsai tree. You just keep clipping it back and want it to fit into a small container. And I say that Anna escaped that container, but she did so while preserving her relationship with him, while really becoming the person who took his intellectual seed and bore it out into the world. And she loved Dorothy and raised a family with her. She did, however, repeat Sigmund's mistake, which was she psychoanalyzed her own children, and they didn't turn out well.
Sigmund Freud sounds as wrong on mental health as he does, women's mental health as he does about their anatomy.
Well, one of the summary statements that I see of this book is that Sigmund developed a lot of his theories about women during the time in which he was analyzing Anna. I can't say that it was cause and effect, but there was a correlation in time. And I find it amusing that his theories about heterosexuality in adult women were born in his analysis of a homosexual woman.
Tell me about Anna's later life.
Well, as I said, she agreed to become a teacher only because Sigmund wanted at that time to spread psychoanalytic theory into the school system, because that was really the way to raise a culture that was psychoanalytically aware. So he needed psychoanalytically aware teachers. So she agreed to become a teacher. And she fell in love with Dorothy, and she and Dorothy started what was called the Matchbook School. And they educated all of the children who were either being psychoanalyzed in Vienna at the time and I think a few that were the children of psychoanalytic patients. And they also started free nurseries in which they took in working children of working class parents and observed them. They were the ones who came up with the observation that you don't need to worry about whether your kid is getting a balanced meal. If every day you serve attractively arrayed foods that constitute a balanced meal, your child will have a balanced meal. Why fight? They were really loving, wonderful parents and teachers. Then the war made them flee. They fled to London and set up their war nursery. And after that, they became teachers and then continued as psychoanalysts. But Anna traveled the world spreading the gospel, according to Sigmund Freud. And she expanded on it, but she never broke his fundamental theories.
She left a few things out.
She left a lot out. But I left a lot out, too, because that's the task of the novelist, is to simplify.
So how's your book being received by the psychoanalysts of the world?
Well, I believe I have an invitation to speak at a psychoanalytic conference in Florida in December. My brother has warned me that this may be like Salman Rushdie going up in front of the imams. I have talked to the Freud Museum in London, and they have said that they would like to sell it in their bookstore. Now, they haven't read it yet. But I am sending them one this week. And people have written far worse about Anna Freud. I've read a book of her as a serial murderer. People have fun with her as a character. This is the first fictional account of her that really tries to stay close to the bone of who she was.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science journalist Rebecca Coffey discussing her latest novel, Hysterical, Anna Freud's Story.
And this brings me to what I believe.
I believe that life is a spiritual struggle.
I believe in being gracious to others.
I believe in the power of science fiction.
I believe in singing badly.
I believe that God lives in the space between people.
I believe in so much more than freedom of speech. And I believe that it is time we all took a stand.
This I believe.
America loves strivers. Whether it's business, politics, or sports, we root for the person who's working hardest to exceed expectations. This I Believe essayist, Tori Merton McClure, is one of those people. She was the first woman to row solo across the Atlantic Ocean, the first woman to travel overland to the South Pole. She's also an author and the president of a university. And yet, as with so many strivers, those accomplishments don't drive away her own perceived shortcomings.
I have demons, so what? People who have no demons are like people who have no sense of humor. They are dull. I am highly educated, so I feel no shame in telling teenagers that I rowed a boat alone across the Atlantic Ocean because I was stupid. Most women do not need to row a boat 3,000 miles to figure out that love and friendship are good things. Most women just get it. My personal demon is a sense of helplessness. I have a brother, Lamar. He is intellectually disabled. When we were young, our family moved every 3 or 4 years. New kids on any block are always tested, often teased, and sometimes hazed. Lamar and I were accustomed to all three. I always tried to protect my brother, but I was not always successful. When I was about 12, Lamar and I were getting to know and be known at a new playground. I was playing basketball. Lamar was standing in his usual place at the edge of the action. A boy picked up a rock and threw it at my brother. As the boy reached out to pick up a second rock, I tackled him. I disappeared into a swirl of fists and feet. Strong hands pulled me off the boy and hauled him away for questioning. The judge and jury that afternoon was a boy named Eric Fee. Like me, Eric would have been about 12 years old. Lamar and I were accustomed to finding ourselves at the center of neighborhood controversies. They never turned out well for us. I had read about justice, but I had never seen it in action. Then something inexplicable happened. Eric Fee hauled the rock-throwing boy over to Lamar and made him apologize. I could hardly believe my ears. Once the apology was complete, Eric called all the children on the playground into a circle. Eric explained that my brother could not defend himself. He declared that Lamar was to be left alone. If anyone taunted or teased Lamar, Eric would settle the score. Someone asked about me. Eric glanced in my direction and said, "I think she can take care of herself." By his actions, a 12-year-old boy created peace and justice out of thin air. And I watched compassion finish ahead of competition. I went out and followed Eric's example as much as I could, as often as I could. With each passing year, I grew wiser, more competent, and more powerful. But no matter how hard I tried, I could not make justice perfect. I could not make it reliable. Time after time, I found myself jousting with injustices that were too big for me to tackle. Each time the helplessness wore me down, I settled for doing something easy, like climbing a tall mountain, skiing across a frozen continent, or rowing a boat across an ocean. Eventually, I came to understand that I could bicycle to the moon. It would not make me any less human. We are each an amalgam of dust and divinity. The dust is essential. It is our brokenness, our helplessness, which makes us human. I believe that love and friendship are the things that make our humanity bearable. Each of us is mortal, and like Eric Fee, each of us is capable of being heroic. We need not accept realities that are not in tune with our hearts. We may not succeed in stealing fire from heaven, but the majesty of humanity lies in our willingness to keep trying.
Tori Merton McClure is the author of A Pearl in the Storm, How I Found My Heart in the Middle of the Ocean, and the president of Spalding University. Her essay was recorded on stage there and independently produced by Dan Gediman. It appears in the book, This I Believe, Kentucky. You can find more information about that book, a searchable database of more than 100,000 essays, and pointers for submitting your own essay at the website thisibelieve.org. The Bob Edwards Show is produced by Ed McNulty, Dan Bloom, Chad Campbell, Kim Dawson, Andy Kubis, Bridget McCarthy, Christy Miners, Jeffrey Reddick, and Shelley Tillman. Find us on Facebook by searching Bob Edwards Show. You'll find audio clips, photos, schedules, and more information about interviews past, present, and future. And you can find this program and many more available around the clock on demand. Go to SiriusXM.com for details. Monday, how guns made the civil rights movement possible. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the weekend. This is SiriusXM Public Radio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.